Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
There is enormous potential from wind energy. Actually, wind has the potential of providing about 40% of our current electric demand. And because of that, and because the costs have declined so remarkably over the last 10 years, I would expect that over the next 10 years, we will see increasing wind power generation.
The good news is that it's a whole lot better than it was when Ronald Reagan was president. The bad news is that it still isn't good enough. And I don't think that we are playing a strong enough international role. I think people like Margaret Thatcher are ahead of us. And that is something that one would not have expected in the past.
Randall Swisher, director of the American Wind Energy Association, will be talking wind turbines this time. And Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, she helped draw up a 7-point plan to save the Earth. Two of our stories and our guests this time on The Environment Show. We hope you'll stay tuned. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Well, as NASA scientists scramble to correct the defect in the Hubble Space Telescope, many are wondering whether the millions spent to launch it was worth it. The question has been asked of the entire space program right from the earliest days. Critics have asked how we on Earth benefit from space exploration. No doubt our opinion would change at least just a little if we could see the Earth for ourselves from outer space. Well, in Santa Monica, Joy Newell went to the studios of artist Tom Van Zandt to see a geosphere, a globe of the Earth made from satellite photos. And Joy says it's unlike anything she's ever seen.
As we sat together in front of a 28 by 40 inch transparency of geosphere lit from behind, the only description of my reaction would be awe. Van Zandt has worked with the project for 4 years now, so he's over the awe and into the pragmatic ways he hopes geosphere will be used to make needed changes.
It's absolutely frightening to see how little green there is.
Well, the first stage of any effective action, and certainly the first stage of any effective giant change in the way we think, is reality. And we have to look at the world. We can't make good decisions if our global consciousness is based upon looking at Earth globes where the primary physical attributes of that globe are political boundaries, which in fact don't even show on the reality Earth as seen from space. So the first step is reality. The second step is suspension of denial. We do in fact have to change. We do, in fact, have to manage our resources as opposed to continue to utilize them indiscriminately. And we do have to fully assume those responsibilities.
Before geosphere consumed Van Zandt's energies, he was a Marine. He was a war correspondent, and then he became an artist, well known for sculpture in public places and for murals. He's a man fascinated by technology. For years, Van Zandt has been interested in remote sensing, or the satellite viewing of the Earth. And when the Geosphere project became formulated, he took it to the National Aviation and Space Administration, NASA.
I was fortunate to receive a grant from NASA to develop the software at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is administered by Caltech, but is also a division of NASA. And to develop the software for the computer programs that allowed me as an artist to do all the compositing of all of these thousands of satellite images to composite them into a whole Earth image.
The geosphere image of the planet is actually many images, as Van Zandt said, although I could not see a seam or a joining anywhere. How many images?
Well, I guess it would depend upon how you count images. Specific scenes, there would be thousands. But the Tyros series satellites and the advanced radiometry instruments that are on those satellites that make these images of the Earth, they do it in strips from pole to pole. They're polar orbiters. And so sometimes a whole strip can be used, sometimes only individual scenes. But the great job was not only geometrically aligning all of this work, The other great job was in, great challenge was in, colorimetrically resolving them one to each other, and then the other was to getting all those scenes that would be cloud-free, so that we could produce a virtually cloud-free image of the whole Earth.
Van Sant insisted on a totally cloudless image for the globe, not because that's reality, but because of the overlays which will be put on top of it, like a computerized photo of the actual weather.
Then we can project, use it like a set, and project onto it, say onto the Amazon. We'll be able to project the satellite imagery from 10 years ago. Or 20 years ago, and show what the state of the Amazon rainforest was in 1970, and what it was in 1980, and what it was in 88 and 89, and what it is today.
Wow. And so you really do have comparative photos of the topography.
Absolutely. We've got these wonderful banks of satellite photos preserved by the Earth Resource Satellite Data Processing Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, operated by the United States Geological Survey and by NOAA. And we're able to not only see the rate of deforestation with this kind of an instrument, but we'll be able to make a risk projection into the future.
Van Sant has a list of some 200 overlays, which will make the geosphere a virtually standing library. In the tape you're about to hear, there's some kind of electrical interference, perhaps because as we talked, we stood near an extremely high-powered computer graphic imaging machine, as he told me about his plans.
Well, first we made the image. Now we're assembling the instrument, which is the geosphere itself that the images will be mounted on, and going all the way from school and home globes, which will have clear hemispherical accessories that go over this reality globe of the Earth, and printed on each one of these accessories will be a different program. You can have the weather of the whole world on one. You take those off and put on another pair of accessories, and which are perfectly aligned to the image underneath, will be all the political borders and boundaries and such. You take that off and put on another one, and there are all the population distribution around the world and energy generation and use. Take those off and put on another one, and it will be the habitat of all the major species in the world and the migration patterns of whales and all the bird migrations and salmon and cod and all the fishery resources. We take that one off and put on one on medicine or agriculture or minerals, and so we have this. So what we're doing is changing the basic concept of what a globe is used for. Instead of being a reference instrument, which it by definition has to be if its surface is committed to a specific information, we're converting it now to a three-dimensional library, which now can come out in the middle of the schoolroom and be used as a world resource education instrument.
Van Sant sees the news media, museums, and classrooms as the primary geosphere users, but he also envisions what he calls Earth Situation Rooms. Just as phone lines and cables bring us telephone conversations and television pictures, Van Sant says technology will bring us real photos of situations anywhere on our globe, like earthquake devastation, for instance. And although the Geosphere Project has turned into a multinational one, and the project has the copyright on any Geosphere image, Van Sant says the marketing of the Geosphere products will be non-exclusive and non-restrictive. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports from KCRW in Santa Monica. The Bush administration has reversed itself on a critical environmental issue, saying now that it will contribute to a worldwide fund to reduce and eventually eliminate chlorofluorocarbons. Earlier this year, the White House said that it would not support such a plan. Changing a policy position like this, however, is a far cry from taking a leadership role, say environmentalists. In fact, say many of the nation's governors. At the end of the 82nd National Governors Association meeting in Mobile, the chief executives signed what could be an influential, if not crucial, document designed to set U.S. policy once and for all on the issue of global warming. According to Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, vice chair of the governor's task force on global climate change, drawing up the plan drew together many otherwise disparate viewpoints.
I think the most significant part of that plan is not really written into the plan itself, but is the fact that all of the governors of the United States of America signed off on it, and that the chairman of that task force was, in fact, Jim Thompson, the governor of Illinois. And a few years ago, if the governor of Illinois and I had sat down together and discussed global warming or acid rain or energy alternatives, you would have seen us complete opposites at the table. We would not have found many areas of agreement. What is remarkable about this policy that the governors did adopt is that both the energy-producing states and the receiving states, as we call the Northeast and New England, really saw eye to eye on most of the issues. There's some differences in terms of how fast we move, what timetables we set. But the fact that we could agree on these 7 points, I think, lays the groundwork for some national consensus and hopefully in the long term, some international consensus.
In fact, the overall scope of the 7-point plan is global, in hopes of emphasizing the connection between what we do here in the United States and what goes on around the rest of the world, and indeed how that which goes on around the rest of the world is connected to and affects how we live here in the United States.
Our first point was to ask for immediate global action and for the President of the United States to take the lead in that regard. And I think that's still very, very critical. I realize at the moment his attention is focused elsewhere, but environmental issues will continue to linger after this present crisis in the Mideast hopefully will recede. And It's I think, crucial that the United States be in the vanguard, be in the forefront in terms of bringing other countries around to higher standards of eliminating the chemicals, the pollutants that cause global warming and that cause destruction of the ozone layer. It also emphasizes very seriously conservation, eliminating CFCs, research, developing alternative forms of energy, and taking steps within our own states in order to ease the problem. So it's a forward-looking document. It's a starting point. It's not the final word by any means, but I think it reflects a new level of national consensus on an issue which has had many skeptics, and certainly the most skeptical have been those states which, in fact, would find some of their energy sources being looked at very differently, maybe even boycotted, if we are to take firm steps in reducing global warming.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you and Governor Thompson, that at one point had been diametrically opposed, now see eye to eye, and that the governors all signed on to this. That is in stark contrast to the United States as a nation versus the rest of the world. Many of the other industrialized nations, Great Britain and West Germany and many others, take a rather dim view of our leadership or lack of leadership when it comes to environmental policy. The Bush administration has now, in fact, reversed its original opposition to helping fund a global CFC reduction program. But as I mentioned, the United States is not seen as a world leader and even considered somewhat recalcitrant on environmental issues. How do you assess our national environmental policy, and do we have one?
Well, it's a tough question to answer, frankly, because I think there's some mixed signals. I think individuals like William Riley, the Environmental Protection Agency administrator, who is a Bush appointee, clearly, is pointing us in the right direction, is a strong spokesman for environmental issues. I think then you have some naysayers within the administration as well, such as John Sununu and Dick Darman, who basically want it all written down in an economic cost-benefit analysis and don't take into account the fact that the environment exacts a very heavy cost if it's mistreated, and sometimes you can't even pay back that cost. at any price. So I think there is, frankly, some tug of war within the Bush administration on some of these issues. The good news is that it's a whole lot better than it was when Ronald Reagan was president. The bad news is that it still isn't good enough. And I don't think that we are playing a strong enough international role. I think people like Margaret Thatcher are ahead of us. And that is something that one would not have expected in the past. So I think there's still some educating to do. I think there's some sorting out. But I do think that there definitely is a different climate and attitude on environmental issues than there has been in the previous administration. But I don't think it's been given the importance that I attach to it, that many, many citizens attach to it, who really are convinced that environmental issues are going to be the key questions of our well-being and also our economic vitality into the next century.
Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, the seven-point plan calls on the entire world to come together on an international agreement to protect the atmosphere. It does no good, the governor say, to make strides in one area while backsliding in another. The plan also calls on the United States to stabilize its emissions of carbon dioxide. The plan also proposes banning the production and use of CFCs altogether, developing alternative energy sources, including wind and solar, and safe nuclear power, to increase funding and participation in forestry programs, specifically to reforest depleted areas. The plan also would begin working on long-range plans to deal with a possible dramatic climate change, including a rise in sea levels. And finally, the governor's plan calls on the world to devote more time and money to research. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Bob Dylan's song of the 60s said it.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
With the storms of political conflict brewing in the Mideast, we may find the answer to peace and energy in the more gentle winds in the mountains and valleys. Often called one of the alternative energy sources, wind is in fact an ancient and proven source of energy, a source that we have not really exploited. And properly installed, a wind turbine or windmill is capable of providing useful energy both commercially and privately.
There are today over 15,000 wind turbines generating electricity for electric utilities, primarily in California and Hawaii, but there are thousands of homeowners or small businessmen or farmers that have individual wind turbines that are being used to provide either electricity or pump water for their own individual use.
Randall Swisher is the executive director of the American Wind Energy Association based in Washington, D.C. Swisher says you might be surprised to learn just how widely useful wind turbines can be.
The amount of power that is generated by the wind is directly proportional to the speed of the wind. Actually, it's a cube of the wind speed, so that it makes a tremendous difference whether you're in a wind speed of 18, 19, 20 miles an hour or 14 or 15. But the Department of Energy has estimated that 37 of the 50 states have good enough wind for utility-grade wind generation. So the wind resources in this country are widely dispersed, really pretty strong in every region of the country other than the southeast. And I would expect that through the decade of the 90s, we would see those resources tapped increasingly.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the placement of a windmill. You've mentioned 37 of the 50 states. Is it possible to deduce where in a particular region the best wind is, and how do we go about finding that?
There are measuring devices available, anemometers, which measure the speed of the wind, and utilities and wind project developers have placed anemometers in many regions of the country to get a good sense of the nature of the winds in a particular region and to begin to then figure out how big a part wind energy potentially could play in their electric generation.
Now, would you have to take a series of readings over a protracted period of time so you could establish whether or not the wind is in fact a constant year-round, or it's just a seasonal gust, or what?
Well, that's right. It would be a big mistake to go out on one day and take a bunch of readings and then assume that that's the way that the wind would blow every day or every year. The wind varies in any region on a seasonal basis, generally. I mean, in California, for example, the winds start picking up in March or April and then peak in the summer months and begin to decline in the fall. 80% of the wind energy in California is generated between March and October. But coincidentally, that happens to match the peak demand for the utilities, which are summer peaking utilities. So it's a pretty good fit between the need to the utility and the availability of the wind in those areas. In some other parts of the country, Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, you would find that the winds are strongest in the winter. And just coincidentally, it happens that utilities in those regions are generally winter peaking utilities. They need more power in the winter. So again, that's a fairly good match.
Of course, one of the biggest problems is that wind does not blow all the time. The challenge is to find either other backup sources of energy or find a way to store the energy generated when the wind is blowing. Additionally, Swisher says, in order to erect the tower of 50 to 60 feet high onto which you would mount the blades and rotor, and you would need a tower of that height, you would also need about an acre of open space, and many, if not most of us, simply do not have that much space to spare. Furthermore, there could also be local zoning restrictions on putting up a tower of that height. Lastly, Swisher says, cost could be a factor as well. The average homeowner uses 500 to 600 kilowatt hours of electricity per month, and a typical wind turbine generates 10 to 20 kilowatts. You would need, therefore, about $20,000 to put up a wind generator of this size. Still, Swisher is hopeful.
I don't look for wind turbines to sprout from every yard. But I think that doesn't diminish the fact that there is enormous potential from wind energy. Actually, wind has the potential of providing about 40% of our current electric demand. And because of that, and because the costs have declined so remarkably over the last 10 years, because of the efficiency with which we are generating power from the wind has increased so dramatically, I would expect that over the next 10 years, we will see increasing wind power generation.
Randall Swisher is director of the Wind Energy Association of Washington, D.C. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. We'll close our show this week with a musical selection, Wind Song, included on a new album by John Denver.
The wind is a whisper of our mother, the earth. The wind is the hand of our father, the sky. The wind watches over our struggles and pleasures. The wind is a goddess who first learned to fly. The wind is the bearer of bad and good tidings, weaver of darkness, bringer of dawn. The wind builds us a rainbow. The wind is the singer who sang the first song. The wind is the twister of anger and warning. The wind brings the fragrance of freshly mown hay. The wind is a racer and a wild stallion running. And the sweet taste of love on a slow summer's day. The wind knows the songs of the cities and canyons, thunder of mountains, giver of mornings. The wind is the symbol of all that is free. So welcome the wind and the wisdom she offers. Follow her summons when she calls again. In your heart and your spirit, let the breezes surround you. Lift up your voice then and sing with the wind. La 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 la.
Wind Song by John Denver from his new album Earth Songs from Windstar Records, released in association with the National Wildlife Federation. And with that selection, we close this week's show. We hope you enjoyed the Environment Show. Next week, news from the Aspen Institute on Global Change and what is happening to our primary schools, its reading, writing, and resources, the environment. Two of the stories we'll be tracking for you next time on the Environment Show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. By the way, if you know of something that you think we ought to know about or have any questions about this week's or any week's show, feel free to drop us a line. We're at The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York, and the zip code is 12206. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.